I spent 23 years in a gray box. I had no human contact, no TV, no radio, and if I went to yard, I was always alone.
That's a former prisoner, Brian Nelson, last year on the 21st. Now, Senator Dick Durbin has proposed a new plan to reform the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons. Plus, recent cuts in Medicaid drug reimbursements may have big consequences for independent pharmacies.
This is a program that's affecting all of community pharmacy, and it's one that I think will have a devastating impact if it's continued to stand.
That's the executive director of the Illinois Pharmacists Association, Gareth Reynolds. And you're probably aware of endangered species, but what about endangered places? Illinois' endangered spots are all part of this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Pharmacy advocates are sounding the alarm, saying that recent cuts in state Medicaid drug reimbursements could have serious business consequences for its independent members. That's according to the Illinois Pharmacy Association. We're going to be speaking with them in a few minutes. This has to do with the April 1st expansion of the state's Medicaid Managed Care Program to every county in Illinois and how much people are being, or pharmacists are being paid for that medication. In some cases, the dispensing fees that were once as much as $5 per generic drug or $2.40 for a brand name drug now could be as low as 45 cents. Andy Hudson is with us now. He's the owner of Hudson's Drugstore in Paxton in central Illinois. They've been independent for almost 70 years and are in a town with none of the big chain pharmacies. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Andy, this dispensing rate situation, how much is this affecting you? How many of your patients are on Medicaid?
We have probably about 10 to 15% of our patients are on the state Medicaid program. So we're not as high as some of the areas in the state, but we do still have a significant amount of people that are.
And how much is this? How much has this changed? It sounds like a really big price drop. If you were getting as much as $5 per drug and now you're getting as low as 45 cents, are you seeing that?
Yes, and unfortunately with our business, a lot of times you don't really see it when it happens. You're kind of retrospectively looking at report and things like that. So in preparation for this interview, I was looking at our statistics, and a couple months ago we were making, so you get paid a dispensing fee and then an ingredient cost besides that. So we were making around $7.49 a prescription, which we feel is a fee to at least try to get close to break even. And now we're around $2.50. So we'd have to fill three times the prescriptions just to make the same amount that we were making before.
As I mentioned, the Illinois Pharmacy Association, its executive director, Garth Reynolds, is also with us. Hi, Garth. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Garth, can you explain what this dispensing rate is that Andy's been talking about?
Yeah, so the dispensing rate, as Andy was alluding to, when pharmacists are reimbursed for medications through not only just the Medicaid program, but through traditional insurance as well, they are reimbursed for the medications themselves and also paid a fee or a dispensing fee that is supposed to cover overhead costs that the pharmacy would incur in preparing the prescription. And what we're seeing, Medicaid has traditionally been a lot lower than what we would normally see for a dispensing fee. If you look at current studies that are out there, both by the National Community Pharmacists Association and the National Association of Chain Drug Stores, you would see that a professional dispensing fee should be closer to $10.66. So we were already significantly under what the national recommendation should be for covering those costs. And now we're going from that $5.50 for the generic and the $2.40 for a brand and taking that down to 45 cents. So as Andy alluded, he's having to try to increase his prescription load by three times just to try to make up for that cost. And what we're seeing is, you know, as Andy said, you know, his percentage is around 10 to 15%, but we have pharmacies that it's closer to 40, 50% of their business. And one thing to keep in mind, one in four Illinoisans is on Medicaid. So we're not talking about a small portion of the population that this is impacting pharmacies with. This is 25% of the state's population that this program is covering, and 80% of that population is in this new managed Medicaid program.
Andy, so you're trying to make up the volume of this. Do you feel like this is going to make the cost of doing business, is this, I imagine, yet another thing that makes staying in business tough for an independent pharmacy?
It is. I mean, as you know, we also had an income tax increase last year as well, so that didn't really help matters either. But I think when I alluded to tripling our business, that was kind of more theoretical. We are from a town of about 4,500, so to triple our business is not really possible.
And as you mentioned, you're in Ford County in central Illinois. Can you remind us what role your pharmacy plays in the community? As I mentioned, there aren't any big chains like CVS or Walgreens in your town, are there?
No, and we're always evaluating our business. And, you know, there comes a point where you want to help the community, you want to help people in need, but you have to stay open for the rest of the population. So if we would decide that we just can no longer sustain these losses and cut ties, these vulnerable people that are on Medicaid would have to travel 10 to 15 miles to the nearest pharmacy to be able to get their medications. And we don't have public transportation in Paxton, so they're going to have to figure out a way to drive to get there. And sometimes that's not always that simple.
Garth, are you, as you said, this is an issue that's going to affect people all across the state, as one in four people in Illinois are on Medicaid. And I wanted to ask you, when you're looking at these numbers and this huge discrepancy now, what are you worried the consequences will be, particularly, as you mentioned, for pharmacies with maybe if this is half of their business?
Well, we're worried that, to be direct, we're worried about closures of pharmacies. And that's nothing that we say very lightly. I mean, it is an unfortunate situation. And as we've said with legislators, this is the most egregious action that we've seen placed upon pharmacy in a significant number of years. Right now, we have about 575 independent pharmacies throughout the state that, you know, proudly serve their communities. And I could see where we could easily lose 50 plus with this program if it continues to expand, and that would just continue to compound on itself as the program would continue. We're already seeing from some of our from our owners reporting back to the association right now that they're already looking at projections that they will have to close locations this year.
Do you think this is designed to make it harder for independent pharmacies to do business, Garth?
I don't think the initial intent was to do that, but how the program is being administered without any real oversight is allowing this issue to have the effect that we're seeing right now.
So, Andy, Garth, are you worried about how this will affect your ability to do business in terms of surviving? Andy?
I have a lot of colleagues that are getting letters from CVS asking them to purchase their pharmacy, which is a little bit fishy since CVS runs these programs. And in other programs, we've seen where CVS pays themselves more than they pay the independent pharmacies. Now, we don't know that that's happening with this program, but in other ones, we have a lot of hard evidence that it is.
Garth?
CVS Caremark or CVS Health administers a majority of the programs that are in the statewide portion of the Managed Medicaid program. And in our testimony that we've given since last year, and we've done it earlier in January and then last week, we saw last year that CVS pharmacies, they closed 11 of their stores up in the Chicagoland area for specifically saying that it was Medicaid reimbursement rates is the reason they closed. Well, that was also in one of the pilot program areas for the Managed Medicaid program, which they're the processor for, and they're as a pharmacy benefit manager. So they were causing stress on that program, not only with themselves, but overall other pharmacies in that area. And now they're sending out letters to independent pharmacies going, hey, are you being troubled and burdened by underwater and under your cost reimbursement levels? We could help out with that by buying you out. I mean, so you're seeing a company utilizing predatory practices to utilize taxpayer dollars to increase their bottom line and increase their market share. I mean, that is a complete misuse of the public trust.
And I guess this is only in effect because, as we're thinking about the idea of this with volume, this is something that would affect smaller businesses more than the larger chains like a CVS, Caremark, or Walgreens. Is that correct, Garth?
I would say that they would have an impact, but as a business is larger, it's able to sometimes handle some of that load a little bit easier. But we're even seeing some of our members that are what you would consider to be small regional chains are having some strains under this as well. So this isn't a program that is having a huge impact on the 1 and 2 store pharmacy owners, and it is still having an impact as it goes up the line to the larger companies. So this is a program that's affecting all of community pharmacy, and it's one that I think will have a devastating impact if it's continued to stand.
Garth, for the Illinois Pharmacists Association, what needs to be done here?
We're asking our members to continue to reach out to their legislators as they have. We've been able to move House Bill 3479 out of the House and hope we can continue the momentum that we have currently with getting it heard in the Senate. And the legislators are listening, and what we're trying to get across here is that this is a program that is having a devastating impact on providers, specifically in this case pharmacy. We're just trying to help preserve the sustainability and operations of pharmacy so that we don't have an access issue in this state. And this managed Medicaid issue is not just a pharmacy issue. The whole program is being reexamined because it is impacting negatively on multitude of healthcare providers, including physicians and hospitals.
Andy, for Hudson's Drugstore in Paxson, as you said, you will have to evaluate if you will be able to continue to serve Medicaid patients. Is that where you guys are at right mm-hmm. now?
That's where I'd be at right now, just because of the extra services that we offer. I mean, we do offer free delivery to even places outside of the community, and we feel like we spend a lot of time with our patients, too, with our pharmacy professionals. That makes cost of business a little bit more for us, so those are all factors that come into play when we decide if we want to continue this or not.
That's Andy Hudson, owner of Hudson Drugstore in Paxton, Illinois, a family-run business that's been around for 68 years. I want to thank Garth Reynolds for being with us as well. He's executive director of the Illinois Pharmacists Association. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
We did reach out to both the Walgreens company and CVS Caremark. Walgreens declined to comment. CVS sent us a lengthy statement that I'll get to in just a minute as I introduce our next guest. Dean Olson is with us now. He's a reporter from the State Journal Register, and his reporting on this actually inspired today's conversation. Hi, Dean. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dean, can you first explain a little bit? Can you just back up a little bit and explain why this rate change happened?
Yeah, this is part of an expansion of Medicaid managed care that was first started. Well, it came under the previous governor, Governor Quinn, but when the Affordable Care Act expanded the eligibility for Medicaid in Illinois, that added 600,000 to 700,000 people to the program, and as part of that, the state was moving toward trying to make the Medicaid program more efficient and adding more people into the program increased that importance. And so under Governor Quinn and then more under Governor Rauner, the state wanted to do a better job of getting control over the rising costs of Medicaid, although the costs of Medicaid actually are not rising as much as the overall cost of health care. But these are direct taxpayer dollars, and so it's easier to hold people accountable for it. And so the state issued contracts to managed care companies. These are private companies. And then the private companies are serving statewide, which is different from previous iterations of this program, and starting April 1st, that's when the statewide aspect of the program began. And then the managed care companies contract with what are called pharmacy benefit managers, and those are like CVS Caremark that actually set the rates, the reimbursement rates for the pharmacies.
And so in this case, CVS Caremark is actually the pharmacy benefit manager in the case of this contract.
Well, there are several of them.
Okay.
CVS Caremark is one of the largest, and there are several of them, and it's come under scrutiny in this case because CVS Health is the parent company. It has CVS Pharmacies and CVS Caremark. So CVS Pharmacies were sending out these letters to pharmacies saying, hey, we know you're in trouble because of low reimbursements. Why don't you let us acquire you? At the same time when CVS Caremark was cutting the rates and creating many of the cost pressures. Now, CVS says that this is not a coordinated effort. There's a firewall between these two organizations.
Right, and I should say, Dean, CVS also told us yesterday when we reached out to them about this segment, I mentioned they did not want to come on the air, but they did send us a lengthy statement, and they said that it was an accusation about these letters. They said that it was outdated and it wasn't accurate and that the practice was discontinued in the fall of 2017, which is obviously a difference from what we just heard from Andy and from Garth. But I just wanted to point that out to everybody.
Yeah, I think that is when the letters stopped, but that's not that long ago. And these letters have been cited not just in Illinois, but in several other states where the exact same situation is happening. Managed care is being used by states to try to get control of healthcare costs, and pharmacies are being squeezed. I would add that there's far from conclusive evidence. There is not conclusive evidence that Medicaid managed care even saves money for states, but it does allow more certainty in what costs are incurred by the states. And so Caremark or CVS Health says that they stopped this practice, and it's funny because I had a story today. They said they stopped this practice because of a perception problem. Well, duh, yeah, it's creating a perception problem, and it's creating a problem in all the state houses.
Yeah, Dean, we're going to have to take a break, but if you hold on a second, we will continue this conversation on the other side of this short break. I know there's a couple more issues I want to get into with Dean Olson, who's a State Journal Register reporter. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about changes to the state's Medicaid managed care program in terms of how much pharmacies are getting reimbursed for this. There's been changes now as reimbursement rates that were once as much as around $5 per generic drugs, $2 for brand name drugs, are now getting 45 cents. And we've been talking to independent pharmacists about this, as well as the Illinois Pharmacists Association. My guest right now is Dean Olson. He's a reporter for the State Journal Register, who's also been reporting on this issue. Dean, just to get into, again, this point about these pharmacy benefit managers. So basically, the states, as you were just summarizing what you were saying before, with ACA enrollment in Obamacare, we started seeing a lot more people enrolled in the program. The state at the same time, as to your point, was trying to figure out a way to save costs. And that's part of what's behind this change here. I wanted to just ask you again about the private companies now that are processing these payments to pharmacies. One of them is CVS Caremark. And CVS did say, to their point, the point that was raised earlier about whether or not they wanted to put these smaller independent pharmacies out of business, CVS said that independent pharmacies are an important part of their network. They're actually 40% of it, and that it's an important way for them to ensure that members have access to pharmacy services no matter where they live. And they said it makes no sense that CVS Caremark would want to push them out of business. We need them in order to have a successful pharmacy network. So that's a statement that CVS sent us. Dean, what more can you tell us about these contracts and companies like CVS Caremark that are running this for Illinois now?
Well, I think one of the frustrating parts for journalists and for the general public is that it's hard to verify a lot of the statements that are being made by the managed care companies and the pharmacy benefit managers and the pharmacy chains, because the contracts that the state has with for administering the managed care Medicaid program, they allow for a lot of not everything is public in the contracts. For example, when the pharmacy benefit managers might save money by reimbursing the pharmacies at low rates, it's unclear how much of that savings gets passed on to the managed care companies or how much of that savings gets passed on to the state.
Mm.
That is viewed as proprietary information, and we don't know. So when
CVS says to us, like they said to the 21st, no, we're reimbursing independent pharmacies at a higher rate than chain pharmacies in our network, you're saying there's no way to verify that.
That is correct. And the Illinois Pharmacists Association says data they've gotten in other states where apparently there's more information available on these contracts contradicts that statement. Also, CVS made that same statement to me, but declined to provide any data backing up its statement, saying it was proprietary information. What's also unclear is what this will mean for the state long term, because if more pharmacies go out of business, not every one of them will be acquired by a big chain. And so if there's less access, that's bad for everybody. And that is also bad for the politicians who are controlling the rollout of this managed care Medicaid program. Governor Rauner yesterday surprisingly was asked about this problem that the pharmacists are talking about, and this was at an event where he was celebrating small businesses in Illinois, and these are all small businesses, these pharmacies are. And he basically said, well, he declined to defend them. I mean, he basically said that some businesses are able to withstand competition and some businesses are not. And he didn't come to their aid at all, and they basically felt, the pharmacies basically felt like he was throwing them under the bus. And so it's interesting because these are mega corporations that are behind these large chain pharmacies. And it's unclear whether the savings that is being wrenched out of these small businesses is being passed on to the state. Although the small businesses do have a constituency. This bill to reinstitute fee-for-service rates to the pharmacies passed with bipartisan support.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That was just my last question to you about this bill. Is there already a bill that passed the House that would change this?
Yes, it passed by a strong margin last week. It passed the House. Now it's in the Senate. It may be tweaked further. That's just how legislation happens. And then we don't really know if it'll go into law, because if the governor vetoes it, there has been some difficulty with getting Republicans on board with vetoing their own governor. And then there's an election coming up, so that ramps up the pressure on all of these folks. So there is momentum by this Illinois Pharmacists Association to tweak the system back. And the pharmacists point to some evidence in one or two other states that when they reverted back to a fee-for-service system that there was savings incurred. So it's hard to really know what is right, because this rollout to managed care in the states, it has had a checkered past. Like I said, studies are not conclusive on whether it really saves money long-term. And what you do know, what is clear, is that many people do have a relationship with their pharmacists in their communities, whether it's at a big chain or a small mom and pop. And these are viewed as the most accessible healthcare professionals. You don't have to set an appointment to go in and talk with them. They're available all the time. They're one of the most highly rated professionals in the public as far as satisfaction. So there is political power that these folks have, and what will result from this effort, it's really unclear right now.
That's Dean Olson. He's a reporter with the State Journal Register. We'll tweet out a Dean's reporting on this. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Recently, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, along with some of his Democratic colleagues, including Cory Booker from New Jersey and Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, introduced legislation to reduce the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons. Called the Solitary Confinement Reform Act, it would also improve access to mental health services for these prisoners and provide resources to state and local jurisdictions to assist them in reforming their own confinement practices. In a moment, we're going to be talking more about these practices here in Illinois. But first, I spoke with Senator Durbin about this issue last week, and I asked him how widespread the use of solitary confinement is in our correctional facilities.
Here's the interesting thing. The states are way ahead of the federal government. Many of the states took a look at solitary confinement and said, we have a problem here. When you isolate a human being from contact with other people, it works on their mind, and it isn't a positive influence. Some of them are going to have much more serious issues and difficulties because of it. And the fact of the matter is, the vast majority of people in prison, even those in solitary confinement, will one day be released. So the states have started walking away from this separation or solitary confinement. The federal government has too, but slowly. I think we need to take a hard look at it. There are certainly cases where isolation or separation is definitely needed for the safety of the prisoners and guards and others around them. But let us be extremely careful that we don't take a person already suffering from a mental illness and make it even worse with isolation.
And certainly in Illinois, we haven't seen necessarily Illinois walking back from the use of solitary confinement.
Years ago, I went down to a place called TAMS, a prison deep southern Illinois, and it's been closed now, but they had isolation and solitary confinement. I'll never forget as long as I live walking into one of those cell blocks where there were five men there who were in isolation, two or three seriously mentally ill, no question. You could just tell from brief conversations. And another, really a dangerous man, who said, if you ever put someone in my cell with me, I'll kill him. And he did. You know, that sort of person has to be carefully watched and isolated and separated. But, you know, by and large, we have to ask ourselves over and over again, is this the best thing to do? Is it the only thing to do? Is it a way to protect those in the prison population and to make sure the inmates coming out of this experience are going to have a better chance outside than they do inside?
That was Senator Durbin speaking with me recently about a new federal proposal he's backing to reduce the use of solitary confinement. To talk more about this issue now, I'm joined by Alan Mills. He's the executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center in Chicago. He's at our studio in Evanston at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Hi, Alan. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you.
Alan, as we were listening to Senator Durbin, the first thing he said was that states are often doing better than the federal prison system, in his opinion, as someone who wants to curb the use of solitary confinement. I wondered if we could just start with getting a better picture of what's happening in Illinois. How many people are in isolation who are incarcerated here in our state?
You need to be careful as to how you define isolation. The international standards are 22 to 24 hours a day locked up. If you use that standard, Illinois has about 8,000 people that are locked in their cells all day long. Most of those are not there because they violated some rule. They're there because Illinois has limited all programs. So there's literally no reason for them to leave their cell, no opportunity to leave their cell. So these are people who haven't done anything wrong, but they are still held in segregation.
And I wonder then if you can define the terms for us then, because we say solitary confinement, but as you're saying, there's isolation, there's extreme isolation, there's segregation. What do all of these different terms mean?
The terms are interchangeable. What matters is what people are actually experiencing, and that's why I like to use the term solitary. It's not a legally defined term, but internationally, it is known as anything where someone is locked in their cell 22 to 24 hours a day without meaningful social contact. And that is applied around the world, so that's the standard we like to use. Every state calls that something else. Some of them call it segregation, call isolated confinement, some of it call extreme isolation, special housing units. There's a million names for it, but it's all the same thing. You're locked in a cell and you don't have any contact with other people.
And before we get any further, just to have a sense of what this is like, we wanted to play some interviews we had done with someone who works with you, actually, at the Uptown People's Law Center. We spoke with Brian Nelson last year. He was in solitary confinement at TAMS, to the system that Senator Durbin was mentioning previously. Brian Nelson was in solitary at TAMS for more than two decades. Here, he described for us what it was like.
When I arrived there, I had no idea why I was there. Nobody there knew why I was there. And I remained there until I was 20 days from release. You're stuck in this box by yourself, and you sit and sit and sit, and there's nothing there. You'd count every hole in the door, every hole in the wall. I used to be able to recite off the top of my head what's in toothpaste because it was the only thing I had to read or do. I began pacing to the point where I was pacing 18 hours a day. And depression set in real bad. When I arrived at TAMS, I was roughly about 185 pounds. And at my lowest point, I was down to 108 pounds. I literally lost the will to live.
That was Brian Nelson. He was a prisoner who was in solitary confinement for 23 years in Illinois, part of that at TAMS, as he was saying. He now works with our current guest, Alan Mills, at the Uptown People's Law Center in Chicago. Alan, that's really tough to hear. And I think when people listen to that, a lot of people are probably wondering how common is that experience that Brian went through?
It's extremely common. I personally met with almost everybody who was at TAMS. And since TAMS closed, I met with hundreds of men that are and women who are isolated in the Illinois prison system and more traditional solitary units. And I think that Brian's experience is absolutely indicative of what everybody goes through. I haven't met a single person who went through any lengthy period of time in solitary, and I'm talking like more than 30 to 60 days, who hasn't come out of that experience damaged.
Hmm. Senator Durbin mentioned in some cases, Alan, that he thinks it's necessary to have some isolation measures. Do you agree with that?
Well, some isolation measures, yes. There's no question that there are some people who are dangerous, but that does not mean we need to lock them in a dark cage and keep them there 24 hours a day without any human contact. There are many ways to keep people safe. One of the things, for example, that is used in some states, but not Illinois, is they can attend classes in what's called a restart chair. So it's sort of like your first grade chair where you had a little desk that folded on top of it, but the desk is attached to the chair and there's chains so you can't get up. So people are confined to that chair, but they're still with other people. They can still interact with other people. And there are lots of those sorts of opportunities around. There are lots of ways that people can interact with other people and still maintain their safety. And I have to emphasize, though, that what Senator Durbin also said, which is mental health treatment is crucial. Right now in Illinois, among those people that are formally in segregation, that is those who have been charged with doing something wrong and are being punished for it, 75% of that population is also mentally ill. So if we fix the mental health care, we'll be able to get an awful lot of these people out of solitary entirely.
And to your experience, Alan, do you feel that in lieu of actual mental health care, solitary confinement is being used instead?
Absolutely. There's no question that what we do in Illinois is lock people into cages and leave them there because we don't know what to do with them. We don't have the resources we've decided not to spend the resources necessary to treat them.
And how does this work? We did reach out, by the way, to the Illinois Department of Corrections. They did not get back to us, but we did also speak with AFSCME, the union that works with correctional officers. And they pointed out sort of they did send us a statement that talked about the different circumstances in which someone would be put in. And they used the term single cell segregation. They said that some prisoners request it for their own protection from themselves or for other inmates. And then some are assigned there. Do people request this? How does it work? How do people end up in this?
Well, people end up in single cells all the time for a huge variety of reasons, but that's not the same at all as solitary. As I just said, there are lots of ways that somebody can be in a cell and still mingle with other people when they're not in that cell. Almost all the cells in Illinois were designed as single cells to begin with. That's the way we used to run our prison system, is with single cells, and then people would be out for education, for jobs, for vocational school, that kind of thing, or on the yard most of the day. So most of Illinois' cells were actually designed for one person to sleep in. What's happened is we converted so many of those cells, because our prison system is so crowded, into two-man cells, and instead of it being a place to sleep, it's a place where you spend all day long.
We need to take a break, Alan, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with you, Alan Mills, from the Uptown People's Law Center. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. listening to The 21st.
I cannot ride a bus. I can't get on a train. When that door closes, I start to panic. I get scared and terrified. I'm in self-imposed solitary now. At the law center, I work upstairs alone, and basically everybody just leaves me alone to work. At home, I'm alone most of the time, and it's sadly, it's what I know. From 14 years old to 46, I know how to be alone. I don't have social skills like the normal person does. I did something wrong, and I deserve to be held accountable for that. I didn't deserve what happened to me.
That's Brian Nelson describing to us his experience in solitary confinement for many years, 23, in fact, including at TAMS Supermax prison in Illinois, which has now been shut down. He helps former prisoners now with the Uptown People's Law Center in Chicago. Its executive director, Alan Mills, is with us from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. Alan, as we listen to that, you were talking about just before the break, that's Brian's experience, and you were also sharing just the fact that our prison system is so overcrowded now that part of the problem is simply that the way the system had been built with single cells is not being used as much. I just wanted to ask you about Senator Durbin's efforts, if you think that kind of effort at the federal level will lead change in Illinois.
The devil is always in the details. So I have to say, I think Senator Durbin's efforts are fantastic. It's really good that the federal government is taking leadership on this issue or beginning to take leadership on this issue. He's absolutely right. They're behind some states, but the federal government certainly has some sway. There's two big issues. One is, at least to my knowledge, the text of his bill is not yet publicly available, so I can't say that I've read it. But I understand it includes incentives for the states to follow along. Exactly what the states are supposed to do and what will be funded becomes crucial. I want to know what sorts of limitations do the states have to put on solitary confinement in order to qualify for the federal funding that's available. But beyond that, I think what the federal government does in its prisons often sets a standard, not a legal standard, but just a way the prisons are supposed to operate for the states in general. So I think if in fact the federal government moves substantially away from solitary, it will be a good thing for everybody.
And Alan, how much of the role do private companies play in all of this, private contractors that are carrying out these assignments?
Private contractors play a very small role, actually. In Illinois, there are no private prisons. We've outlawed those. In the federal system, there are some, but they tend to be concentrated at the minimum security level. Those are more profitable run. So most of the prisoners that are held in solitary in the country are actually held in publicly owned and operated prisons.
And I wanted to just end by asking you about a lawsuit that we spoke about last time you were on the program. It's regarding six Illinois prisoners who filed a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections, calling the extreme isolation they were put in for years as brutal conditions. It was on its way towards becoming a class action suit. I just wanted to ask you what's going on with that now.
We are mired in discovery. As usual with lawsuits, they take a long time. So we're in the process of collecting data, and shortly our experts will begin to tour the prison system. I do have to circle back to the federal government one second. I'm a little concerned about what the federal government is also doing, because here in Illinois, they are about to open, or they're in the process of opening, Thompson Correctional Center in the northwest corner of Illinois. The federal government currently has one supermax prison that it operates in Colorado. This will be a second one. So while the bill does good things, the actual what's happening on the ground appears to be a vast expansion of the capacity for solitary in the federal system. So we're very concerned as to what's going on in Thompson. The federal government has not made it publicly available what security level Thompson will be. All we know is that they've spent millions of dollars increasing the security there from what was already a maximum security prison when it was built.
That's Alan Mills. He's executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center in Chicago. Alan, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Of course, you've heard about endangered species, I'm guessing, but what about endangered places? Landmark Illinois has just released its annual list of the historic places in Illinois that are most at risk of the three Ds. That would be demolition, deterioration, or development. Making this year's list is the Thompson Center in Chicago, an example of postmodern architecture that might be demoed by its owner, the state of Illinois, and the Coliseum at Illinois State Fairgrounds in Springfield in DuQuoin, which may need more than $180 million to repair. Joining me now to talk about other endangered places is Frank Butterfield, the director of Landmark Illinois in its Springfield office. Hi, Frank. He's actually joining us from our partner stations, WUIS in Springfield. Hey, Frank, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you so much.
Frank, can we start by you describing what an endangered place is? How are you defining that?
Sure. As a membership-based nonprofit organization, Landmarks Illinois has released this list of most endangered historic places for this. Now this is the 24th year of having this list, and it's really calling attention to historic places in our state that are under threat by, as you mentioned, demolition, inappropriate development, or insufficient funding. And this year especially, we're looking at the bicentennial year of the state's history and looking at all of Illinois' history, even beyond the 200 years, to highlight places that are very significant but under threat.
And we have two folks from endangered places, two of these places on the line with us as well. From Fairmont City, Robert Gallis is on the line with us. He's the owner of The Night Spot. Hi, Robbie. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And we also have with us Reverend Dr. Sterrett Collins. He's the pastor at Central Congregational Church in Galesburg, another endangered place. Reverend Collins, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Robbie, let's start with The Night Spot. Your family has owned this in Fairmont City for multiple generations. Can you tell us about its history? And your grandparents, I know, bought it in 1947. Where is it located?
It's actually located in Fairmont City, Illinois, which is pretty much just across the river from St. Louis, Missouri, literally like 5 minutes or so from St. Louis, Missouri. They had purchased the property back in 1947, and actually at the time it was just a one-room junkyard, per se. And my grandfather was actually laid off from the Granite City Steel Mill there in Granite City, Illinois, and had decided to purchase the property with the intent of going and putting a restaurant in. He had always wanted to open a restaurant, him and my grandmother did. So like I said, they had bought it in 47, spent about a year or so remodeling it, and actually had it up and going in about 1948, you know, mid-year or something like that. And they ran that from 1948 all the way till my grandfather died in 78, and then my grandmother continued to run it till 1984 when her health started to go, and then we decided that, you know, it was probably too much for her to do anymore.
So how have you all managed to stay open for, it stayed open from, as we were saying, from 48 to 87. What do you think the secret was to the longevity of The Night Spot?
I think a lot of it was, being it was the Route 66 road at the time, there was a lot of traveling along Route 66, of course, and with the truck drivers, just people traveling cross country, vacation in general, they just happened to hit it right with the food. They also actually went and would cater to the truckers. They sold a lot of sundries, for example, like talcum powder, shavers. They actually even sold toys and stuff at the time. So when the truck drivers were traveling across country, they could actually pick stuff up for their children if they didn't have time, you know, to actually make a stop somewhere else to get them, say, something for Christmas if they were running behind getting home from them. So I think between the food and also with being, it was actually a 24/7 restaurant where I think at one time they had up to like 12 waitresses. So they were really, really busy all the way through the 50s and 60s, and then kind of started slowing down really into the 70s, when Route 66 was not as busy and popular due to the interstate systems. So they did have a really good following, though, for many, many years.
And Frank, because the reason that, is it because of the location on Route 66 that you all at the Landmark at Landmark Illinois are interested in this, the Night Spot?
Yeah, with Route 66, especially when we highlighted Route 66 last year as well, we see thousands of tourists spending millions of dollars coming from Chicago into California. And this is it's a tourism and job creating destination for the state of Illinois. And so we really want to highlight, you know, what the tourists want to see. They want to see that authenticity, like the neon sign that hangs outside the Night Spot Cafe. In addition to the state focus, we're seeing a nationwide focus, as Representative Darren LaHood from the 18th District has introduced legislation to make Route 66 a National Historic Trail. So I think you'll see, in addition to our statewide attention on places like the Night Spot Cafe, you're going to see a nationwide larger attention to the benefits of Route 66 to the country.
Reverend Collins is also with us from the Central Congregational Church in Galesburg. The church was built in 1898. We'll tweet out the pictures and share some at 21stshow.org. Reverend Collins, though, for the people who haven't seen the church, can you describe what you think is so impressive about it architecturally?
It is a very impressive building. It is right on the square in Galesburg. It was built where the first church in Galesburg had been, but when that got to be too small, two congregations got together and built this big building. It was intended to be not just a place of worship, but also a place where there could be concerts and what is often called a community hub right now. And it served very well in that respect.
And including Carl Sandburg has a relationship with the church as well, correct?
Yes. Originally, the sanctuary was built to hold about 1,000. Plus, there are these walls between it and the next room over that could be opened up and seat as many as about 1,300 or 1,400. But the last time those walls were open was the last time Carl Sandburg spoke here, and They're old now and not as usable.
And so why, Central Congregational is on this endangered list now, from your viewpoint as the pastor, why is it vulnerable?
Well, it's vulnerable because there's a lot of things that we have not been able to do a lot of the preventive maintenance on or repairs on because the congregation, as most congregations in this country, has gotten smaller, and we're not able to do a lot of those things ourselves. However, we're hopeful of being able to grow some again. We're excited about things that are going on in the church, and we hope that we can do that. But at the same time. There are some things that could happen suddenly, like we could suddenly need a new roof, and that would cost quite a bit, and we wouldn't necessarily be able to fund that ourselves at this time. Or some of the big, beautiful stained glass windows could be hit by a storm, and something big would need to be done to repair or replace or even just board those up.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a big building. Robbie, can I ask you about the Night Spot? Why is the Night Spot vulnerable now?
What it is, the one wall, unfortunately Fairmont City down there has issues with what they call basically like a gumbo-style dirt. Almost a lot of the homes down there that have basements tend to have issues with believe it or not, the basement walls tending to tilt in and have issues with cracks in that, almost like too much hydrostatic pressure. And it's not uncommon to say there might have been, 50 to 100 homes that had to have new basements where the actual homes were raised up and new basements put underneath them.
Oh, and so because of that, Fairmont City, has the Fairmont City now condemned the site?
They have tried to condemn it, and we did have to get a lawyer involved. And actually kind of put it on hold, so we do have an August 15th date. And what it is, the one wall of the basement there, because it actually has a basement to house all the refrigerant systems for the coolers and such upstairs. Well, the one wall had given way. So we had it braced for a while now with the intent of going ahead and fixing that wall.
Well, Robbie, I'm sorry. I hate to cut you off, but unfortunately we're at the end of our show. We're out of time, but we'll have more information about this at our website. Frank Butterfield's got this list. I want to thank Robbie Gallus,
and Reverend Derek Collins for being with me today to talk a little bit more about these endangered places. As I said, you can head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on that. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning in today.